going to be looking at a passage from John chapter 14 and opening here in just a moment. But in John chapter 13, we have here the culmination of essentially the last week of the life of Jesus. And it starts a few chapters back. The majority of the book of John is dedicated to Jesus' activity within the last week of his life on this earth. And it really culminates in chapter 13, where the Last Supper and the Passover is made, and Jesus establishes the Lord's Supper. And prior to that, John gives us an account of how Jesus takes this cloth and washes all of his disciples' feet, demonstrating the humility that was going to be necessary to be a Christian, to be one of his children. And it's also within this context that Jesus very specifically and very clearly identifies his betrayer as Judas Iscariot. No doubt this weighs very heavily on his heart and on his mind as he knows that his time on earth is near. And he cries out to his disciples, one of you is going to betray me. And he goes so far as to identify that to Judas, that he was going to be the one to do so. And at the end of that chapter, we have Jesus there predicting the denial of Peter that's going to take place. And likewise, all of the other disciples as well, whenever they are confronted by the chief priests and by the Pharisees and those people who seek to put Jesus to death. In chapter 13, Jesus is speaking of very difficult times that are going to be coming as he will soon be departing from this earth. And his work is going to be handed off to those disciples. So it's no doubt and it's no surprise that in chapter 14, the first three verses there, the words that Jesus speaks in lieu of this impending disaster and challenge that's going to soon overcome their life are words of comfort and words of reassurance. And we'll have a PowerPoint up in just a moment, but go ahead and turn to John 14 if you'd like to follow along. And this is what Jesus says to his disciples. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. So during this challenging time that his disciples are soon going to be facing, he offers them these words of comfort and these words of reassurance, telling them that he's going to go somewhere, he's going to leave this earth, and while he may not be here anymore in their presence, he's going to prepare something better for them. And then in verse 3, he makes this promise to comfort them that where he is, where he's going, they too will be able to be with him. You know, as we consider this passage, oftentimes the context of it, sometimes it's read at funerals, it's read at times when people are experiencing challenges in their faith, in an attempt to reassure and to comfort and to bring appreciation to the better things and the better days that we have to look forward to. It's important for us to have balance, and I know that the sermon this morning was, for me, one that was challenging, and so this sermon is something also that I very much need to hear. Because while we looked at this morning, perhaps one of the greatest obstacles to the Christian who's trying to live his life faithfully, here we're going to look at this evening in contrast, perhaps the greatest motivation that we as Christians have to maintain our faith, to stay faithful regardless of the difficulties that we may face, because all of you can attest in one way or the other, and I'm sure you have your own story, multiple stories to tell. But life is challenging. Life in and of itself, whether you are a Christian or not, is difficult. But life as a Christian can be even more difficult. And so we need passages like this and we need sermons like this to remind us, to reassure us that as difficult as things might be, it's important for us to maintain our faithfulness so that, as Jesus said to his disciples in that wondrous thought, where he is now, preparing that place, he can one day come and he can take us who have loved him and lived faithfully before him. So this evening, we're going to spend a few minutes of our time talking about heaven. Heaven, like so many other things that are spiritual in nature, it's hard to comprehend with our finite and with our physical mind and the physical mindset and the outlook that we have. I'm turning to Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21, I'd like to begin by reading the first seven verses, and we're going to look at this evening or just a few of the attributes that we find of heaven. Now, when you turn to Revelation and you look at it and you read this, I believe that what John is talking about can be specifically identified within this context as the church. However, as you look at, he describes it, and as John is witnessing this vision, he's called up in the Spirit to witness this vision. He's describing a scene, a place where things are going to be better, where God is going to be. So we're going to look at a few of heaven's attributes this evening. Begin reading with me, if you will, in Revelation chapter 21, beginning in verse 1. In this vision, he says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." Then he sat on the throne and said, "Behold, I make all things new." And he said to me, "Write, for these words are faithful and true." And he said, "It is done. I'm the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain and the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things. And I will be his God, and he will be my son." As you consider this passage here, and you consider these thoughts of heaven, that enter your mind is this beautiful depiction of a place that we can't even begin to imagine is described for us. And as John relates to us as best he can in human words and human terms, something that we can't even begin to comprehend. One of the things I think that really appeals to us and stands out in stark contrast to this world and all that is in it is what he says in verse 4. Specifically, that in heaven there will be no more death. Death is something that in this life is feared above all other things. And if you look at this world and you look at the perspective that people have, and you look at science and the advances in science that are done, how we dig further and further and deeper into science, people go to great extremes to prevent death, to delay death. Science is able to bring about all sorts of cures for illnesses that in times past would have cut the life of an individual who possessed those short. Organ replacements and the wonderful things that are able to be done with things like that. To be able to extend the life of one who may be in such terrible physical condition that for them there is no hope. Devices that keep someone alive who may be perhaps on the very brink of death. My brother Zane, middle brother Zane, works at the VA hospital, and I imagine Justin probably can, any other nurses can attest to this idea as well. He says what he oftentimes finds is people in there who are simply living on a ventilator and their loved ones just won't sign the paperwork to have that, even though there's really no life there, there's no quality of life there, that person perhaps is in an unconscious state, but because people have such a hard time saying goodbye, they try to delay that and put that off just as long as they simply can. Because in this world, we have an aversion to death. And the reality is, it's something that we all fear. And it's something that we must all one day face. Can you imagine a life where death does not exist? The very thought is not even in one's imagination. Can you imagine never having to say goodbye to people you love? In heaven, we're told here that there will be no death, where we will no longer have that fear that the psalmist describes in Psalm 23. The valley of the shadow of death that hangs over the head of everyone who lives on this earth. Can you imagine a place where that does not exist? Last year I went to two funerals for family members. One was an aunt that had passed away that never had any religion, never really set foot in a church building. She was a good woman by perhaps the world standard, but I remember that funeral very specifically. And I remember the funeral of my grandfather that I went to, who was a member of the Lord's church and who was faithful during his life up until the very end. And the atmosphere of those two funerals was absolutely as different as night and day. I remember at my grandfather's funeral, there was conversation, there was reminiscing the good times, there was laughter, and there were tears that were flowing. And the preacher who actually did the funeral made the comment, "I don't know that I've ever been to a happier funeral." And perhaps that was the case. Papa was a child of God.
He lived his life faithfully. He done the things that God's Word had called him to do. And though he had died, as hard as and challenging as it was for us and our family to just say goodbye to him and to know that we couldn't ever walk across the street and see him again or have those conversations that we had from time to time, we knew and we took comfort in knowing that he had gone to a better place. And Paul helps us see in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13 that the death of a child of God is not something that should bring about sorrow. It does in the sense that we have to say goodbye, but it's a selfish kind of sorrow. It's sorrow on our behalf because we don't have that person in close proximity to us anymore. We can't share and make memories with them any longer. And so from that perspective, it is saddening to say goodbye to a person. And Paul, as he's seeking to encourage his brethren who believe that they missed the resurrection, says, I don't want you to be ignorant concerning those who have fallen asleep, those who have died, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. And for those who don't have hope of Christ, for those who don't have hope of something better, then death really is something to sorrow over. It's something to be sad about. And I love Paul's description here of death. He says it's sleep. And those who sleep in Christ, here's the thing, that one day they will be woken up. And I can't help but echo the sentiments of the psalmist in Psalm 116, verse 15, where we see that God looks at death in a completely different way than we do. We see that David said, blessed in the sight of the Lord is the death of one of his saints. And truly in the sight of God, while it may be difficult and challenging and sad for us to say goodbye to someone we love, God says that it's beautiful in his sight because in the sight of God, death is one of his children coming home. And while that environment was there at my grandfather's funeral, at my aunt's funeral, the environment and the attitude that was there was very much different. The event was somber. It was quiet. It was sad. And as I watched the people there as they were weeping, there was no laughing. There was no commemorating something better, something grander. When those people said goodbye, I watched them from a distance, and they spoke to their loved one as if they'd never see her again. Because without God, without hope of something greater after this life is over, truly death is something to fear and to dread. One of the blessings about heaven is the fact that death in this world, as challenging, as fearful as it is, it's not going to be there. It will not exist in heaven. And what are you reuniting that will be? Where those who have died in Christ, who have passed on, who have been faithful. I know you've got loved ones who passed on, who have been faithful. I've got loved ones that I'm looking forward to seeing again in heaven because I won't have to say goodbye next time. We have one endless day with those we love and with those who love our Savior. That's an appeal that heaven has to me. Another appeal is that in heaven, there is no sin. Appreciate this fact. All of sin. Everyone's sin. No matter how godly we might try to live and how strongly we might try to refrain from giving in to sin, sin enters into all of our life from time to time. And the consequences of sin and the guilt that it brings in our life is challenging. And it seems to me, as I can't help but keep up with the state that this world is in, that as we watch every week, society seems to sink lower and lower and lower into depravity. We as a nation seem to sink lower and lower and lower. We glamorize relationships that God calls unnatural, that God calls abominable. We see homosexual marriage, and it's running rampant in this country now, and now there's an embrace of that relationship within this country, so much so that just about anywhere you go, you can embrace that relationship, and like-minded people will celebrate that with you. You turn on the TV, it's advocating and glorifying those relationships. You listen to music, it's reflecting those very same sentiments. You even watch commercials on television, and you see them promoting this type of thinking, this new way of living. And you consider that those who are placed in positions of authority are now very disregarded. In fact, there are many people in this nation who make it their aim to seek out people who are in authority, like our policemen, who many who were trying to serve and protect, and to take their life because they oppose authority to that degree. Prejudice has once again risen and bared its ugly head in this nation. However, I don't think there's anything that's more demonstrative of truly how far this country has fallen than the murder of innocent children. This country embraces abortion. There was a new promotion of that going on, and I read an article, and it's just absolutely disgusting to me. It was entitled, essentially, "Shout Your Abortion." And what it encouraged some of these women who had had abortions to do was to retell their experience, to share that with others, so that they may not need to feel shame and guilt for that particular act. And yes, one who does that and gives in to that, they can find forgiveness in God. But we don't even find here someone who has done this terrible thing looking for forgiveness, looking for redemption. What we find them doing is promoting it, celebrating it even. As hard as these are to read, I want to share with you some of the things that were written there. Nothing graphic in nature, but the sentiment of people within this country, because I believe that it demonstrates the depths of depravity that we as a nation have stooped to. Here are four statements that were made around this time regarding this "Shout Your Abortion." This one woman said, "I've had two abortions. I don't have to justify or explain them to anybody. My life is more valuable than a potential life." Another says, "I was pregnant when I didn't want to be. I got to decide, and I owe no one an explanation for my decision." Yet another says, "I've never wanted children, so I had an abortion. I'm thriving without guilt, without shame, without apologies." One says, "I had an abortion, or had an abortion because you wanted one. You need not justify, explain, or hide. Your body, your choice, all day, every day." And we stooped so low that there was a woman last year that actually filmed that taking place. And the things and the sentiments that she expresses during that are a representation of what we as a nation, how far we have truly fallen, how depraved, and if we can descend any lower into depths of depravity morally, I do not know what will be next. But it's absolutely terrible. And I don't say these things to bring you down. I say these things to help reveal and unveil the ugliness of sin. Because I dare not say that everyone that's here would be absolutely disgusted at the very thought of some of the things that I've mentioned. We need to be aware of the fact that God views all sin, whether it be homosexuality or abortion, or fornication, or pride, or lying, or unclean language, whatever it may be. God sees sin in this perspective, and sin oppresses. Sin hurts. Sin brings guilt. Sin brings shame. It disgusts. And it separates us from our God. Watching or reading the news, as I see these things, I can't just help wanting out. Wanting away from all of this. Can you imagine that? Living in a world where there is no sin. Where there is no selfish desire. Where others do not put their interests and their desires and their goals ahead of everyone else's. Can you imagine a world or a place where everyone's kind, where everyone's loving, where everyone is selfless, where there aren't rude remarks being made and there aren't criticisms of others constantly? It could simply be a world that we don't recognize, and that's described for us in Revelation 21 in verse 8, where, as we read this morning, there's going to be certain types of people that are going to be there. Those that are cowardly and unbelieving. Those that are abominable. Murderers. The sexually immoral. The sorcerers and the idolaters and the liars are going to have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. Those type of people aren't going to be in heaven. And he says again in verse 27, "There shall by no means enter into it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." And what's so terrible about the state of this world is we're not a nation that has fallen and has made mistakes, and we're seeking redemption, and we're seeking to be restored, and we're seeking to make things right. We as a nation have embraced these things. We celebrate sin. We laud it. We love it. We all sin. We all make mistakes. And that's not the type of person that's being described here. The person being described here is that person who at their very core opposes God and elevates themselves and places their desires above everyone else's. Those type of people simply will not find residence in heaven. And that's one of the things that appeals to me. Because as I see this world in the fallen state that it's in, it's challenging. And I just want out sometimes. And God says that place that He's gone to prepare for me and for you and for those who are faithful, there will be no trace of sin in that place. We also see that heaven is going to be a place of rest. This is in Revelation chapter 14, verse 13. John describes for us this wondrous place that we desire to go. He said, I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. Heaven is often referred to as the promised land. Now, this is an Old Testament term that was used to describe the land of Canaan. And you can go back and you can read about the promised land as it was described to Abraham and to his children and his descendants. And it was similarly a land that was described to heaven. It was a land that was described as being a place of milk and honey. And it was described as being a place of rest. Now, this was promised to the people of Israel, but it wasn't automatically given to them, this place of rest that they sought after. They spent two generations. And you can go and you can read through the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua, and you can see that these people, these two generations, had to prepare for that place, for the taking of that land. And then there was the actual conquest. They had to go to war. They had to take what God had given them. Joshua led them into battle against their enemies. They made war. They conquered the land. And it was only after much preparation, after much war, after much hard work, that they were able to truly inherit this land of rest in the promised land. You know, the Christian life, as Jesus described it, is not a life of ease. And it's not a life of relaxation. What would be the appeal of rest? Heaven is described for us as a place where we can rest. What would be the appeal of rest for someone who's never worked? For someone who's never made much of an effort? For someone who was not weary from their travels and their service? Worked on the farm a couple of summers whenever I was in high school. That was challenging work. It was work when you were out in the sun, and you'd get out as soon as the sun was out. You'd be out in the fields at 6 o'clock, and the sun would be bearing down. It would be beating on your head. And you'd work till 8 or 9 o'clock, 13-hour days. I know some of the older generation think, well, that's nothing. But for someone like me that hadn't really been exposed to that, I'd come in on those 13, 14-hour days where I'd worked and been out in the sun, and I would absolutely be beat. I would be exhausted. I like to eat, but I'd go to bed without eating because I was that tired. And the rest that you experience after you put in a hard day's work is something that's truly enjoyable. The rest is most sweet for those who have worked. Our work here as Christians is challenging. As we find ourselves struggling with temptation, I don't know about you, but I face temptation on a pretty frequent basis. And as I try to turn that down, and as I try to say no, and as I try to resist that, that really wears somebody down, resisting the temptation that's faced. That we're faced with in this earth. And as I deal with the persecutions that I have for my faith, the remarks, the disfavor that I may find in the life of others, that wears at you, that wears you down. As I consider the work of teaching the gospel and sharing the gospel with others, being rejected time after time after time after time, it really gets to you. As I consider our life of sacrifice, it will wear a person out. Now, Jesus says in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 24, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. So right here it's very evident that Jesus is describing that the life of a child of God, one who seeks to follow him, is going to be a life full of ease, full of simplicity, full of joy, right? Well, the joy can be there, but it's not an easy life. As he describes it, he says, you want to follow me? You're going to have to take up a cross. That idea of bearing one's cross, not an idea that makes us think of rest and ease. Rather, it makes us think of persecutions. It makes us think of hard times. It makes us think of trouble. And truly, that is the life of a Christian. And the sweet thing about heaven is that after living a life of service, after living a life of sacrifice and battle, spiritual warfare, we're going to be able to take our armor off, lay that aside, and enter into a land that God has prepared for His people, where we can truly experience rest from our journey. This is a good indicator of where you are in your life, where you are in your service. Is for you being a disciple challenging? Is it difficult? Or are you cruising right along through life and your faith in Jesus Christ hasn't really caused you any complications? The Christian life, as Jesus describes it, is not a life of ease and relaxation. It's a life of sacrifice, work, and persistence. One of the beautiful things about heaven is that after we put off this earthly body and its weariness and the toil that it brings, we're going to be able to rest from our labors. And what we find out, perhaps the most appealing attribute of heaven, God's going to be there. God's going to be there. Let's read verses 10 through 21. Revelation chapter 21, as John continues to describe for us heaven in all of its glory and all of its splendor. And he tries to paint for us a picture here. Many have taken and misconstrued this to mean something that it doesn't. Remember, John is having this vision, and he's trying to describe for us in earthly terms what he's seen. We see in verse 10 of Revelation 21, he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain. He showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Having the glory of God, her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Also, she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates and the names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. The city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. And he measured its wall 144 cubits according to the measure of man, that is, of an angel. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual was one pearl, and the streets of the city were pure gold like a transparent glass. Now what comes to your mind is, what comes to so many people's mind as John is describing here this great city that he is giving witness to. He talks here in verse 16 about how its measurements were perfect. We sing that song about the city four square. What he's talking about here is a perfectly measured city. It's perfect in all of its measurements. And he's describing the walls and the gates. It's one that's filled with all sorts of precious stones and precious jewels. And we talk about those pearly gates as they're described here in this vision, these gates of pearl that are there. And surely some might think, well, this mansion that Jesus is going to prepare, it's beautiful, and it's valuable, and it's priceless. John is trying to describe for us something he sees in spiritual, something that's spiritual that he sees in terms that you and I can understand. He's trying to give us an appreciation for the beauty and the perfection that he has seen from God. And this is the only way he can do so, by speaking of these very valuable and precious metals and stones. But the true appeal for the child of God is not those pearly gates. It's not those streets of gold. We find the true appeal for the child of God of heaven in verse 22. I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are his temple. The city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. And the nation of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day. There shall be no night there. They shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. And we see there this beautiful city that's described for us. But verse 22 tells us the true glory and splendor and prize that are awaiting those who are seeking heaven as their home. What will truly draw us to heaven? It's not those streets of gold. not that physical appearance, but rather who is there. Let me try to help you understand it in this way. Whitney and I have lived in that little house behind the church building for 6 or 7 weeks now, and it's begun to feel like home. We've got decorations out, and we've got things that are in place, and we've got pictures. It's beginning to feel like home. Now, suppose that one day, whenever I leave the office and I go back to that house, Whitney's gone, and the baby are gone. You're not going to find me beating on that house, trying to find my way in, because that is my home. That house is just a house. Right now, that house is home because my wife and my daughter are there. And let me say this, heaven is going to be our home only because God is there. Not because the city is perfect in its measurement, and not because these pearly gates are there, and not because the streets are paved with gold. Heaven's going to be heaven because God is there. And if God were somewhere else, heaven would not be heaven. And in heaven, we're going to be able to experience God in a manner that man has always sought to experience, but has never been able to taste and never been able to experience. And they sought searching for God in times of all this relationship where they might see God face to face, but there was that constant reminder of the veil and the separation that stood between God and man. And today, people attempt to fill themselves with emotions in an attempt to experience and taste God, if you will. But in heaven, what's truly going to be wonderful is not the beauty of the place, but the beauty of the presence of our Father and of the Lamb, Jesus Christ, who's there waiting for us. And then lastly, think about heaven. Heaven is going to be forever. Eternity, like heaven, is something that is outside of our realm of comprehension. You know, try to think about how long is forever going to be. Imagine that you've got a steel ball that's the size of the earth, however big that may be. Suppose you place one little ant on that steel ball and he walks around the earth time and time and time again. And he walks around the earth, that steel ball, enough times to cut it in half. However long, billions and trillions of years that might physically take. That's one breath in heaven. We may think, what am I going to do for all eternity? There is no death there. There is no sin there. There's no sorrow, there's no sadness, there's rest from our labors, and God is there, shining as the light. 1 second in heaven, in the presence of our God and in the presence of our Savior, would be worth 10 lifetimes of complete and utter servitude. See, heaven will be never ending. We'll close with this passage here and allow John to offer to you the invitation. Revelation 22, beginning in verse 12. Behold, I'm coming quickly. My reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. John places a stipulation on this beautiful place he has described for us in verse 14. He said, blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the city into its gates. Outside are dogs and sorcerers, and sexually immoral, and murderers and idolaters, and whoever loves and practices a lie. There's a story told of a young girl that was terminally ill. And she knew that her life was coming to a close, and the minister had come by to make arrangements for her and to talk out with her how she wanted things for her funeral service to go. And they talked and they reminisced about good times. And she told him how she wanted things to go. She told him what songs she wanted led and what passages she wanted read. And he was preparing to leave. And she said to him, oh, wait, there's one more thing. Whenever I'm buried, whenever this funeral takes place, I want you to place a fork in my right hand. And he looked at her, not understanding what that request was. And she says, I remember all of the potlucks that I used to go to whenever I was young. And how after dinner and after we finished eating all of the courses of food, someone would lean over to me and say, keep your fork. There's something better to come. And she says, I can remember having that desire and that taste for all of the wonderful desserts and the apple pie and the chocolate pies and the cakes and the ice cream and all of those things that I so much more enjoyed than the meal. And so sure enough, he fulfills her request, and time passes, and as he's doing her funeral, she's there, and the songs are sung, and the passages are read, and that fork is there in her hand. No one's able to really comprehend and understand what that was for. And finally, after he gets up and he speaks, he shares with them the request she made to keep that fork, because something is truly better than this life, which is to come. And that's the message of heaven to you this evening. And the invitation of the Lord is open to you now. The Spirit and the bride says, come. And let him who hears, come. And let him who thirsts, come. Whoever desires, let him take freely of the water of life. If you're here this evening, you're subject to the invitation of the Spirit and the bride. Won't you come at this time as we stand and as we sing?